Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy, and this week we're asking, in these pandemic times, how can we better parent our children? According to the World Bank, almost 1.6 billion young people have missed out on some in-person schooling over the last year. But this week, most of Britain's children have finally gone back to in-person teaching. In America, President Joe Biden's self-imposed 100-day deadline for reopening the majority of classrooms by the end of April is fast approaching too. After those seemingly endless weeks of Zoom lessons, the end is in sight.
I do not like homeschooling because I have no one to play with.
I haven't been able to get as much help with schoolwork, and I also haven't been able to see my friends.
It's so annoying and stupid and hard and annoying and stupid and hard.
I love my family, but I'm with them always, every minute of every day. Always.
Even once the school gates have opened again, the impact of this year will stay with those children and their long-suffering parents. As a recent article in The Economist sister magazine, 1843, put it, I'm spending more time than ever with my children. No one is enjoying it. With three of my own at home, I am particularly glad to welcome today's guest. Philippa Perry is a parenting expert. She's been a psychotherapist for over 20 years, and her latest book is The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read, and Your Children Will Be Glad That You Did. So what does Philippa reckon the fundamentals of good parenting are? And how can we overcome those tests of lockdown life and everything that follows? Philippa Perry, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Hello.
You've been working as a psychotherapist now for over 20 years, and I wondered whether the kind of problems that people bring to you have changed much in that time.
No, they don't. And we don't get a different type of problem. We might get a different presenting problem. People might be moaning about social media or something, but fundamentally, people's problems come from their view of the world that was formed in their childhood. And a lot of that is unconscious. And that does not change. That is prehistoric and carries on going on.
And how would you say the pandemic and the situations we're all living in around the world, but in and out of lockdowns, more isolated from each other, it must play a huge role, but are you able to sort of adduce anything consistent from that, other than that human beings don't like to be locked up, told they can't go out and separated from their friends and family, which seems pretty obvious?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we all know why we're separated from our friends and family. We know why. We can look at the arguments and think, yes, that's very sensible that we don't spread the virus around, that we stay isolated. But unfortunately, our body speaks a different language. So you get what we call mind-body dissonance. So you know in your head why you aren't hugging your daughter, but it doesn't stop me feeling on some level rejected that it is happening, that I'm not getting that body-to-body communication that I'm used to. And even if you go for a walk in the park with a friend, one other person, but you spend the time, your regulation 2 meters apart, you might come away feeling sort of flat and empty. Because when we're used to not only exchanging words and ideas and comfort with each other, we're used to having more of a sort of body-to-body connection. I don't know whether it's breathing together or just having a sort of non-verbal bodily dialogue, but we're missing those things at the moment. And unless we sort of find this narrative about the mind-body split, the dissonance, you know, you can get depressed and not know why. But I think a lot of people are feeling very down because this is missing, and it's a human need to be amongst other people.
We reported a large survey carried out at University College London showing a steep drop in happiness since September in the UK, a mood gyration, as we called it. And the thing that really interested me about this was that younger people, who are in many ways at least risk of serious complications or death from COVID-19, came out of it as being a lot less happy than older people who are more at risk, and who I might have thought, had you asked me when all this started last March, will be feeling the isolation more and need even more of that support. Why would you think that demographic difference exists?
I'm 63, so this has been a 63rd of my life. If I was 14, it would be a 14th of my life. That's a lot longer. So children are in it a lot longer than we are in terms of how they experience time. Secondly, if you're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, about that age, your job, evolutionary speaking, is to reject your family and find a new peer group. This is why "I hate you, Mum" sort of happens round about in the teenage years, because it's really important for them to find a peer group that is a sort of secondary family for them, because they need to find an identity away from the family. And this sort of biological need is being denied them. Now, we're all right. You know, me and my husband might be a bit bored at night because we're not going to any parties and not seeing anyone. But, you know, we are secure in our tribe away from our families now. You know, we have made our new family. We've made our new tribe. And so we haven't got this urgency to go and mix. And like, I live on a square, and sometimes I hear teenagers sort of shrieking with delight in the park. And I think, hello, someone's breaking the rules. And although that might be dangerous for their elderly relations, COVID-wise, I just think, I'm not surprised they can't bear it and they're breaking the law. I'm really not surprised. I heard a report of a really nice kind of good listening type mother, and her 13-year-old daughter came down the stairs with a pair of scissors and said, "Mum, take these off me. I'm going to hurt myself because I am feeling so distraught and so much pain, and I don't know why." And so I think it does help if we can make a narrative, however accurate my theory is. There's nothing to prove it. It is just a theory. I like it personally. But I think it's quite good if we can give children this narrative to make sense of why they are feeling so much worse than we are. And we should certainly not shame them for, you know, "Oh, look on the bright side, don't do that." You know, because they are having a really rough time. They should be getting up to naughty pranks together. They should be bonding in a new group. And they're stuck with Mum and Dad, the two most annoying people in the world.
I think I can vouch for that. I think that would be the view from the floor beneath where I'm interviewing you today. I'm fairly secure on that knowledge. And let's talk about parenting, because it's a subject of your new book, the book you wish your parents had read, and your children will be glad that you did. Bold claim there, Philippa Perry. You say, "I wrote the book I wish I had read as a new parent. I really wish my parents had read it." So what kind of parents did you have?
I had really nice parents, well-meaning, good parents with financial stability. I am one of the lucky ones. However, my parents didn't like me being unhappy, right? So I'd get told off for being unhappy. My parents did not like me being angry. I was bad and wrong if I was angry. And this is just a small example of something that goes wrong. So what I wanted to let parents know is that you cannot argue with a child about what they feel. They feel what they feel. And Sure, we can help them find acceptable ways of expressing those feelings, sort of like, please don't break the windows when you're angry. Could you just say you're angry and then we can sort out what's going on rather than you breaking everything? Now, that's sort of a bit of a Joyce Grenfell joke about it, but I really mean it, that we shouldn't tell children off for what they feel. Of course, we want our child to be happy the whole time, and we might feel like if they're not, it's some reflection on us. But we must take what they say seriously, but not necessarily personally. Like, for instance, my father overheard me once saying that I wasn't having a particularly happy childhood, and he went absolutely ballistic. I mean, looking back on it now, I can't blame him. Like, here was I growing up in peacetime and apparently not happy. Who did I think I was? What we need to do on those moments is not look to correct our child, but to connect with our child. So had he said, oh, I overheard you say you're not having a happy childhood, could you tell me a bit more about that? And I might have said something like, I really hate going to school. And if he'd said something like, yeah, oh, yeah, I hated school too, because he did, then we could have had a moment of bonding rather than me feeling I've done something wrong, but I'm not sure what, and feeling like I can't confide in my parents. Because this is what happens if we don't accept our children where they are right now, whatever that is, then they won't have anyone to talk to when they need to talk to someone. I mean, you know, let's have a round of applause for that mum who's kid said, I'm going to cut myself.
Yeah, I was going to say that strikes me as she obviously got to a very good place in a relationship for that to be the response. But you talk about people being triggered as a parent by our children's behaviour. It's a useful term. I'm going to slightly challenge it, Philip, because I think it's also, I have a sort of a bit of a bugbear, which probably listeners to this show know about, which is slightly overly fashionable language, which for some reason always just gets on my nerve. I'm clearly an old soul. And something about being triggered always makes me think, well, the world triggers us all the time. It could just be exhaustion. It could be the stress and boredom of parenting small or larger children in the circumstances that you've described at the moment, for instance. Why is that necessarily to do with the past?
If you find the company of these people that you actually do love irksome, it's 9 times out of 10, not every time, you're right about that, but 9 times out of 10, it's because you were found to be boring. You were found to be irksome, and you don't want to be reminded of that. So much in how we parent, we pass on unknowingly what was done to us, which is why I wrote this book, because I don't think we really want to do that. I think everybody loves their kid, but I wanted to teach people how to like them too. And that's what this book is about, because if we were loved, like I was loved, but I don't think I was particularly liked a lot of the time, you know, because a 3-year-old isn't necessarily the best company for a 40-year-old, unless that 40-year-old does the transformative act of seeing the world through a 3-year-old's eyes, and then they can learn from it and have a fantastic time. But if that wasn't done to you, it's very difficult to know how to do it, which is another reason why I wrote the book.
What I'd love to know is how scientific you think this is and how much you can make and test theories in psychoanalytic practice, and how much is it storytelling? You're a great storyteller. You know, the audience will have got that. Your fan base around your books and events knows that. So the stories, in a way, sort of become a truth, and people will say, yes, I do see that, you know, I can identify with that. That is a long way from being able to say, I can prove this.
I think after nearly 3 decades in practice and hearing about hundreds and hundreds of people's childhoods, and that is true, yeah, it's rooted in story, hearing their stories and learning from them what their experiences have been. And not only that, I'm a psychotherapy supervisor, so I supervise other psychotherapists. So I hear all of their stories and all of their clients' stories. So my book is on a sort of a base of thousands of stories. Plus, where it is possible to test a theory scientifically, and a lot of psychotherapy research is qualitative research rather than quantitative research. But where you can do it quantitatively, such as we could with, say, sleep training, then I do use scientific methods. If it's a what you reckon theory, I make the difference quite clear, I hope, in the book. I mean, sometimes, for instance, what we talked about at the top of this interview, we talked about mind-body dissonance. That is a theory based on experiential research. It's not a theory where you can get a test tube and put it over a Bunsen burner and see if it changes colour. But it's something you can tell people that helps. And sometimes the closest we can get is a feeling of resonance with what is being told. If it resonates with them, that's great. If it doesn't, then maybe we need to dig deeper and see what's going on.
I mean, this must be, I should think, a bit of a double-edged sword for someone who is in your kind of work. You have a daughter, she's grown up now. Do you find yourself thinking, I did this right with my daughter and I can recommend this, I can put this across? What do you do with the more negative memories?
Of course I made mistakes in that sometimes I didn't get her or I misattuned to her. You know, no one does anything perfectly. Any relationship isn't about perfection. It's about relating. And so, yeah, there was that time that I didn't believe her, that a cow knocked her over. But I found out later that it was true. And I was really sorry that I hadn't believed her. And what I was doing then was remembering how much I used to lie as a child to get attention, because I wasn't getting the right sort of attention, and assume that she was doing the same as me. No, she's a different person. She doesn't do that sort of thing. And
she was knocked over by a cow.
She was, yeah. And I was sorry that I got that wrong. I mean, I must have got masses wrong. But it's not about being a good mother or being a good dad or a bad dad. It's about relating. And when we make mistakes, we can go, my bad, I got that wrong. Like we do with our friends. They know if you're off. They'll know if you've got something wrong. So you might as well fess up to it so you don't mess with their instincts. So I think we should fess up a lot more as parents than the generation before were in the habit of doing.
You wrote this book before the pandemic. Family life has changed massively in that time, not least because, according to the World Bank, in 2020, temporary school closures kept nearly 1.6 billion pupils out of school, with all the constraints, the loss of learning, but also for the most vulnerable children, the risks that involves. So I wondered how you see the trade-offs as having worked out.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, Granny has another 15 years of life, and why should that be taken from her? And yet on the other hand, children are desperately lonely without their peers, without the playground. I think the learning you can catch up on if you're interested and if you're curious, you will catch up on that. But I do think there is a price to pay in terms of our children's development, because they are taken away from their peers. I'm not going to judge it as it was the bad thing to do or it was the right thing to do. I don't know whether it was, but we've done it. And there will be a price to pay for it. Whether that's a price worth paying or not, it's not up to me to say.
And is there a fundamental difference between a child-parent relationship and the child-teacher one? Because one thing I would say, I can see certainly my colleagues, and you won't be surprised to hear that a lot of people actually on the Economist radio team and wider colleagues sort of fed into to the questions that I'm asking you. And I think there was a a group of people, perhaps with younger children, who just feel that they are being pushed as parents into this role of teacher, and that neither the child nor they are comfortable with that.
No. Children, for some reason, don't like being taught by their parents. And I think after a certain, you know, after primary school age, the best a parent can do is facilitate learning rather than teach it. What children get to associate with at school is the structure of the day. You know, you line up, you hang up your coat, you know the rules of the classroom, you know where you get your pencil from. So all of that goes out of the window when you start learning from home. Teachers also know how different children learn. Like, some children are naturally numerate and some have to visualise numbers. But you'll probably present the work how you were taught to learn, and it might not work. So that will cause problems. Children have lost their autonomy at the moment. One way to help that better is to give them a restricted choice. So you can say to them, you can do your English worksheet or your maths quiz now. You know, give a command as a sort of choice. It makes it a little bit easier. The other thing is, if you've got an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old and they've got completely different learning, and you know you've got a full-time job and you're supposed to teach these children at the same time, it's easier if you adapt the work to fit both kids. So say it's English comprehension, the 8-year-old will have to write some sentences about the story, but the 4-year-old can do a drawing. So you sort of adapt it like that.
And all of this is happening, as a colleague points out, in a slightly plaintive question: how can parents get work done when children are in Zoom meetings demanding attention? Do we need to think about a timetable of work and parenting?
I think children should be part of work more. I think we should stop taking them to Disneyland and pretending the world is a beautiful land of childhood. It isn't. It's a land of work. I think it's nice for children to see their parents at work and to realise there's certain codes to follow when they are at work. And I just love it when there's a sort of professor or a doctor giving a really serious bit of news on the news, and their 3-year-old starts crawling all over them. I think it's beautiful. And I think their work doesn't take away from it. And we can all wait a minute. You know, we're not in such a hurry. We can wait a minute while the child pulls her hair and crawls all over her. I love it.
So we should change our mentality around it rather than changing, you know, or having a firm kind of division.
I can remember, it's such a great memory for me, going to work with my father when I couldn't be looked after at home for some reason, and going to a joiner's shop, you know, lots of machinery, probably very health and safety, not good, and just feeling that I absolutely loved it. And I was just, you know, I don't know, I was 6 or 7, and I was just watching all these machines at work. And that was better than Disneyland. It really was. And I just think more kids should go to work.
I don't know. I'm going to ask the audience what they think about that. I think they'll be split. I think some people will be completely cheering for you and others will be like, no, I need my space. I want to ask you about this idea of quality time. It's something we had a piece about in our 1843 magazine by a writer called Mark O'Connell. And he basically went into the origins of this idea that it's not how much time you spend with your children, but the quality of that time, which he says only arose as a phrase in the 1970s and didn't really take off till the 80s and 90s. What do you make of the idea of quality time, short bursts of highly focused attention being better than just kind of mooching about?
I think what makes a good childhood are not, you might call it quality time, the trips to the fun fair. They are the ongoing, daily, normal interactions. Mooching about with each other, with respect for each other, is a jolly good thing.
So mooching rather than focused quality time, which I suppose is something a lot of busy parents do rely on.
The idea of focused quality time sounds like you focused on the kid. It smacks a little bit of being the doer and the done to me, rather than a mutually impactful relationship, which is what children need. Sure, partners and children will make bids for attention. If we manage to answer 7 out of 10 of those bids, we'll have a good relationship. If we answer only 3 of 10 or less, we'll have a bad relationship. And that is done in a lab that they found that out. I'm not making that up. It's from the Gottman Institute. And so if we decide to have a family, it's normal that the family are going to make bids for attention on us, be that from your partner or the children. And I think we need to be available for at least 7 out of 10 of those bids.
7 out of 10. This is my new benchmark.
If we can take it for granted that when we need attention, we get it, then we don't have to keep testing that relationship out. We don't have to keep trying it. That's when we train children to be annoying, when we don't give them enough attention and so they have to manipulate us to get it. If they can always take it for granted that they're going to get the attention they need, they don't become pains. You tend to get back what you give.
You said in your book called How to Stay Sane, which was one of our books of the year a few years ago, that sanity wasn't about normality. It was about a flexible position between rigidity and chaos. And that suggests that there are many ways in which one could describe or even sort of practice sanity. I mean, how do you feel this period has been for your own sanity?
I think that sanity is interesting, isn't it? There's the DSM, the Dialogical Statistical Manual, whatever it's called, DSM, that has got hundreds of ways of defining insanity, but they don't define sanity at all. Which is what I attempted to do in that book, What is Sanity? And I'll tell you what I think sanity is at the moment. It's having an appropriate response to what's going on. So I think it's okay to be sad. I think it's okay to be lonely. I think we don't have to be relentlessly cheerful in the current circumstances. And I think when we tip over into insanity is when we start to get neurotic and maybe fantasize about other people rather than checking out with them. So it's when we start to get paranoid that everyone's against us or everyone's horrible or something like that. That's insanity. But sanity, it's quite appropriate to feel sorrowful right now. I mean, Thomas a Kempis in the 15th century, a monk up in the north of England, he didn't write books on how to be happy. He wrote books about how to be properly sorrowful. He thought sorrowful was the appropriate thing to be. And I think we need to take a leaf out of his book right now, because it's appropriate to be sad when we're prevented from being with our loved ones.
Philippa Perry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And we'd love to know what you think. I've certainly had food for thought from what Philippa Perry was saying there. What have we learnt about our relationships with our children or with our parents during this tempestuous year? Perhaps you found your limits, or that you were capable of feats of patience and creativity you didn't imagine, and all from the room next door with someone else banging on the ceiling. Write to us, radio@economist.com, or tweet us @economistradio. And if I might add a favour, do leave us a rating. Better still, a review on Apple Podcasts. 5-star 1 makes our week. We learn from everything, and it helps us immensely. The producers were Rosie Pye and Abasoye Oshundero. I'm Anne McElvoy, signing off to go and help with the maths homework. Oh joy. In London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.